Support for The Exchange podcast comes from you, our listeners, and from McLean Middleton, New Hampshire's largest law firm. For over 100 years, they've been committed to their clients, community, and colleagues. Locations in Manchester, Portsmouth, and Concord, New Hampshire, and Woburn and Boston, Massachusetts. Learn more at McLean.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The U.S. appears close to a new trade agreement with Canada and Mexico. And in New Hampshire, many people are pleased, from the governor to the state's business community to members of our congressional delegation. Officially, the deal is called the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Agreement, or USMCA, but it's also been called NAFTA 2.0, after the North American Free Trade Agreement, which it updated. That deal, signed 25 years ago, was often criticized as lacking effective labor and environmental protections and was blamed for American job losses. Supporters of this new treaty say it mostly addresses these problems, and today in The Exchange, we find out more. As always, let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Comment on Facebook, tweet us, or call in 1-800-892-6477. And joining us with the latest on this deal from New York is Jen Kirby. She's a foreign and national security reporter for Vox. And Jen, thank you for taking time out. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Laura. It's great to talk to you.
So how surprising, Jen, and significant is it that President Trump and House Democratic leadership are both saying they like this?
It's definitely a rare area of partisan agreement, particularly on trade, where Democrats, Republicans, and Trump don't always see eye to eye. Trump brought back the USMCA deal in the fall of 2018, and Democrats have insisted pretty much since then that they wanted things like stronger labor and environmental enforcement. On the flip side, U.S. Trade Representative Bob Lighthizer has always said he wanted to get bipartisan support for this deal and other deals. So they both wanted to reach consensus, but they started out pretty far apart and seemed to be at an impasse for most of the year. But last week, I think it was, Democrats said that they believe they got what they wanted, particularly on things like labor and pharmaceuticals. And most importantly, U.S. labor, specifically the AFL-CIO, endorsed the deal, which it hasn't done since the early 2000s. So with all those people on board, it seems like it's a go.
How much is it a done deal or a go, as you said? Because these treaties aren't just a function of the president saying, I like this, and that's it, right? There's other entities that have to weigh in.
Absolutely. I mean, it's never a done deal until all three countries ratify it. But right now, Mexico, the U.S., and Canada had all signed on to the new changes that the Democrats had agreed to last week. Mexico had initially ratified the USMCA in June, I believe, and it approved the new changes last week. So things are pretty much set there. There were some last-minute objections from Mexico, but there was not much maneuvering, and it seems to have been resolved. The House, I believe, is set to vote the implementation legislation out of committee today and should vote for the full House this week. And it's expected to pass with bipartisan support. There might be some progressive Democrats who don't agree and might vote it down, but for the most part, it looks good, and the Senate should take it up in early next year. Canada probably will do the same, may have a little bit more trouble just because Trudeau lost his majority, but it's also supposed to pass there. So everything is looking good, but you never know what can come up along the way.
Sure, with all those political entities in three different countries. President Trump, Jen, has been clear from day one that he thought NAFTA was terrible and some Democrats didn't like NAFTA either. How come? What was the perceived problem with NAFTA?
Yeah, the president, I believe, has called it the worst trade deal ever made. His biggest complaint, I would say, about the original NAFTA, which has been echoed by some Democrats, is that NAFTA hurt employment in the United States, particularly manufacturing jobs that were lost to cheaper labor in Mexico. Economists say the actual economic picture maybe is a little bit more complicated, doesn't necessarily take into account automation, which also happened during that period. But I would say, job losses is by and large the biggest criticism that politicians have levied at NAFTA.
And Democrats didn't like it either because they felt like it didn't have proper labor protections, that it didn't do enough to protect the environment and so forth. Right, Jen?
Yeah, absolutely. NAFTA did have labor and environmental provisions written in, but the enforcement mechanisms were pretty weak. And so that allowed for a lot of abuses and things to slip. And that was one of the Democrats' sort of main goals in going into this new revised NAFTA 2.0.
So how different is this NAFTA 2.0? I've read some analyses that say it's, 80% the same. Somebody else said it was 90% the same. What's your assessment, Jen?
I think it's definitely an updated version of NAFTA or NAFTA 2.0. And there are some pretty significant changes, particularly when it comes to rules about automobiles and even some of these changes to labor. But it is not a wholesale reimagining of the agreement. Sort of the main kind of skeleton structure is still there. The question will be, will this new deal, I think, fix some of the complaints that U.S. politicians have had about NAFTA for the past, decades or so?
And you talked about Democrats, Jen, and how they pushed for some of these changes, including labor and the environment. What about Republicans in Congress? How do they feel about some of the changes that have been made?
So Republicans have mostly kind of gone on board. Their main objection when the USMCA was initially kind of signed was that the Trump administration hadn't removed steel and aluminum tariffs on Mexico and Canada, and that was sort of their holdup, which the administration struck a deal in May to get that all taken care of. So they've been pretty much on board since then. There's been some grumbling. Senator Pat Toomey, for example, of Pennsylvania had said that he thought maybe some of the labor protections went too far. But I think for the most part, Republicans seem on board, and mostly businesses want it, and that's good for them. So Republicans seem to be supportive.
And we'll talk in a moment to New Hampshire representatives from labor organizations and from the business community. A couple just last quick questions for you, Jen, please. What other major aspects of this agreement do you think are important for our listeners to know about?
Yeah, so I mean, I think some of the big things, of course, are these new tougher labor rules. So the agreement calls for about 40 to 45% of automobile components to be made by workers to earn at least $16 an hour by 2023. And this is supposed to target Mexico to sort of bring up labor standards with the goal of also kind of trying to make U.S. and Canada more competitive so that jobs don't necessarily go over back to Mexico. That's good for Mexican workers, of course, too. And they also have greater labor rights, like the ability to unionize and some protections for migrant workers and women. And so the Democrats ideally have added more teeth to those provisions so that there will be labor enforcement panels that can investigate allegations of worker abuses in factories that will hopefully make that more strident. And I would say the other big change is the rules for cars. It used to be 62.5%, now 75% of parts need to be manufactured in North America for cars to receive zero tariff. So that's going to, increase the amount of things that are made in North America. The idea is to keep businesses here, but it may also make the cost a little bit more expensive. So the question will be, what will be the impact of that?
Oh, interesting. Okay. And as you said earlier, this agreement appears close to approval. Any obstacles that you see, Jen, that might get in the way?
I always hate to make predictions, particularly when it comes to politics. I would say, the big question will be how many Democrats do get on board. A lot of moderates really wanted to get this deal done, but there have been some objections. Green groups, for example, say some of the environmental protections don't go far enough, don't mention climate change, for example. So maybe some progressive Democrats might resist there. But so far, I would say it is looking pretty successful in the House this week, and we'll see what happens from there.
Jen Kirby, thank you very much for helping us out. I appreciate it.
Great. Thank you so much.
That's Jen Kirby, foreign and national security reporter for Vox. Again, today in the exchange, it's a New Hampshire look at the new U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement, which, as we heard, updates the North American free trade agreement. Both President Trump and House Speaker Pelosi call this new agreement a vast improvement over NAFTA. And this hour, we're going to find out what is in this deal and what it might mean for the Granite State. Let's get your questions in at 1-800-892-6477. Email us, exchange@nhpr.org. And with me in studio, Matthew Beck, business representative for the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers in New Hampshire and Maine. Matthew serves on the legislative committee of the New Hampshire AFL-CIO. And Matthew, nice to see you. Welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Also with us, Jim Roach, president of the Business and Industry Association of New Hampshire, which represents 400 members in industries including manufacturing, high tech, financial services, healthcare, and more. And Jim, welcome back to you, too. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Laura.
Well, Jim, how important is trade with Canada and Mexico to us here in New Hampshire?
Well, it's very important. Canada and Mexico are among our top trading partners. Canada for New Hampshire ranks number two, a close second behind Germany, and Mexico ranks number four, actually ahead of China. So that's kind of an interesting factoid. 3,500 jobs in New Hampshire are directly related to trade with Mexico and Canada, and another 50,000 jobs are indirectly related or tied to trade with these two countries. One in four manufacturers in New Hampshire do business in Canada and Mexico, and the BI has long felt that manufacturing drives New Hampshire's economy in a way that no other sector does. So all sectors are important, but manufacturing has a very strong economic ripple effect throughout the economy. So, 74% of the manufacturers in New Hampshire that are exporting to these two countries are small and mid-sized companies. So these are very, very important trade relationships flowing both ways.
Well, it's interesting that you gave those numbers about jobs directly connected to trade with Canada and Mexico. So what sorts of jobs are we talking about? And what sorts of companies?
Hypertherm, for example, exports to Canada. Manufacturers, you know, in this economy have clients all over the country and in many cases all over the world. You know, New England Wire Technology has exports to Mexico, for example. And some of these companies actually have operations in Canada and Mexico. So it's a big, strong piece of New Hampshire's economy. 21% of our exports are to those two countries alone, Canada and Mexico.
Wow. And as you said earlier, Canada is number two in terms of trading partners and Mexico is number four. You know, it's interesting, Jim, when people look at New Hampshire, we think of the Midwest as like the Rust Belt and the heart of American manufacturing. But you're sort of painting a different picture of manufacturing and what it looks like. These smaller high-tech companies that end up exporting a lot.
Yeah, well, the fact is manufacturing in New Hampshire by gross state product is number two behind, I think, healthcare. And I would argue that manufacturing, like mining and construction, generates wealth. Other sectors of the economy don't. They sort of feed off wealth generated in other parts of the economy. And so manufacturing, by virtue of its wealth generation, then has much stronger tentacles throughout the economy. And there's a lot of manufacturing. Obviously, we know the largest manufacturer in New Hampshire, a very strong company in southern New Hampshire, BAE Systems, you know, employs about 5,000 people. But they have hundreds of suppliers that that feed into their production process. And that happens throughout the state. There are a number of smaller manufacturers scattered throughout the state that are feeding into the work of larger manufacturers that are also based here in New Hampshire. So it's a big piece of the economy, and a lot of their products go to Canada and Mexico. So really, if I may, the most important aspect of the USMCA is that it preserves these trade relations that exist today. So the numbers that I just gave you are trade today. Without a new NAFTA, without the USMCA, those benefits would ebb and flow away. And there are things in the USMCA that are expected to enhance trade with among the three countries.
Which we'll definitely talk about. And I know there was a lot of concern about NAFTA getting ripped up and nothing replacing it. And Matt, last time we talked, I think we were talking about NAFTA, and you really didn't like that deal. A lot of labor unions did not. How do you feel about this new deal, especially as it compares to its predecessor, NAFTA?
Definitely an improvement, but still room for a lot more improvement. I mean, the deal is a far cry from the type of transformative trade policy that would serve as a template for new trade agreements moving forward. The entire Fair Trade Coalition that's been working on the issue is committed to continuing to work together for better policies in the future. I mean, a year ago, the Trump administration offered a really weak, worse than the original NAFTA proposal that was wholly unacceptable. It was rigged for Big Pharma in order to lock in high medicine prices, and it failed to make the changes needed to stop outsourcing, raise wages, protect worker rights, and defend family farms and safeguard the environment. And if it wasn't for the relentless effort of organized labor and leaders in the Democratic House of Representatives like Congresswoman Custer and Congressman Pappas, the Trump administration would have been very happy to enact their NAFTA 2.0 that would have handcuffed the ability of Congress to lower prescription drug prices. But, you know, so despite this progress, there's, you know, we consider the new NAFTA an improvement. but it should be the floor for future trade agreements. The Trump administration's claim that the new NAFTA will bring back hundreds of thousands of manufacturing jobs is just completely untrue and unfounded.
Now, why is that? Because that is the promise, and that is why the president did not like NAFTA. He said it had sent manufacturing jobs to Canada and Mexico.
Well, it's not designed to do that. I mean, it will, I think, potentially help to eliminate future outsourcing. I mean, New Hampshire lost, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, going back to the most recent quarter we have numbers for, the first quarter of 2018, and New Hampshire lost over 21,000 manufacturing jobs during the NAFTA era, and over 12,000 of those were directly tied through trade adjustment assistance to these trade agreements.
So it isn't just that productivity increased or that automation increased. Those are sometimes also causes of job loss.
Sure. Those are factors. But, we're encouraged by the tougher labor standards with swift and certain enforcement that can help prevent the bleeding of good jobs in New Hampshire and throughout the United States. But it's unlikely that this deal in and of itself is going to bring those jobs back.
We'll definitely talk a little bit later about what happened with pharmaceutical companies, because that's been a big point in this trade deal. But I'm interested in the language you use, Matt, fair trade. You said, I think this is a step towards fair trade. What is fair trade in your mind?
Well, fair trade is when you're not pitting workers in the United States against workers in Mexico, for example.
Who get paid
much lower wages. The problem around NAFTA has been without really enforceable labor and weight and environmental standards. It's just frankly cheaper to do business in Mexico. So it's unfair for workers in New Hampshire to try to compete against workers in Mexico who are just earning so much less.
How does the deal attempt to improve that situation, Jim? I know there's some stipulations about that Jen mentioned that certain percentages of cars, I think, that are manufactured, or maybe it's all products, have to be made by workers who make $16 an hour,
right,
at least.
Well, one note that you touched on is that during this time when manufacturing has declined in New Hampshire and around the country in terms of number of jobs, companies have invested in productivity and robotics and lean manufacturing. So they become more productive. That's certainly one of the factors for why manufacturing numbers have declined in New Hampshire.
So you can't always blame trade for the loss of manufacturing jobs.
But more to your point, the trade agreement, the USMCA, does require that 40 to 45% of a vehicle being built in any of these three countries must be made by workers earning at least $16 an hour. And that's really an attempt to both try to increase the wage scale for Mexican workers who earn on average about $8 an hour in that sector, but also possibly move some of these jobs back to the United States and Canada. In the production process, if you got low wages, that's where in this agreement some of that work is going to go, but part of the attempt is to bring those jobs back to the United States.
All right. Well, coming up, we will talk a lot more, and we'll hear from a New Hampshire intellectual property lawyer on how digital companies fared under this agreement. And we'll start taking your questions and comments. You can join us with a phone call at 1-800-892-6477 or an email exchange at nhpr.org. We'll be right back.
Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest in You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Canoy. Today, what the new U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement means for New Hampshire, Give us your questions and comments about this new deal. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Tweet us, comment on Facebook, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. With me in studio is Jim Roach, president of the New Hampshire Business and Industry Association, and also Matthew Beck, business representative for the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers in New Hampshire and Maine, and a member of the Legislative Committee of the New Hampshire AFL-CIO. And another New Hampshire voice that I want to bring into our conversation now is Ann Bartow, director of the Franklin Pierce Center for Intellectual Property and a law professor at the UNH Franklin Pierce School of Law. And Ann Bartow, welcome to The Exchange. Thanks for being with us. I wanted to ask you about the intellectual property angles of this deal and sort of the digital economy. One disappointment that Speaker Pelosi mentioned for her in this deal was the inclusion of language from what's called Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. Many people have called this a gift to big tech. I would like to just roll back a little bit with you, Ann, please. What, first of all, is the Communications Decency Act?
Sure. So that was passed in 1996. There was an initial wave of internet pornography that Congress sort of hit, kind of blindsided Congress. So they passed an act called the Communication Decency Act. And the primary intent of the CDA, it was called the CDA usually, the primary intent was to facilitate, you know, keeping children away from porn somehow on the internet. But it was drafted very, very broadly, and frankly, most of it was inconsistent with the First Amendment. So eventually the Supreme Court knocked most of it down as unconstitutional. Remaining, however, was Section 230. That was not struck down. So Section 230 is basically, I would say it's a pretty gift, a good big gift to big tech. Other people might tell you that, in fact, other people would tell you that it's needed to have the First Amendment in cyberspace, and some people get very hyperbolic and say that without Section 230, we wouldn't have the internet or we wouldn't have these big companies or so on and so forth. The Section 230 says the most important part has to do with a good Samaritan blocking and screening. So it says no provider or user of an interactive computer service shall be treated as the publisher or speaker of any information provided by another information content provider. And the theory, supposedly, at least by some people, was that if you made it so that online companies didn't, if they took stuff down, that they wouldn't be liable. In other words, if you know, users said, hey, you took my stuff down, the idea was we would immunize the big tech companies for taking down harmful things. So then they were supposedly going to be more motivated to take things down. But, I mean, it gave them this really broad immunity. There's just very few exceptions to this immunity, and basically it wound up in a structure where online platforms have less liability, much more freedom, and far less accountability than real space publishers. So what that means is, well, let me talk about the foundational case on this was Zarin versus AOL. So there was a guy named Ken Zarin, and after the Oklahoma City bombings, for some reason, some person who's never been identified put a notice on the AOL bulletin board that said Ken Zarin was selling naughty Oklahoma T-shirts, which had these tasteless, offensive slogans about the bombing of the Alfred Murrah Building in Oklahoma City. And then the message said, call Ken in Seattle, Washington, and it actually gave his phone number. Well, he didn't put those T-shirts out. I mean, who would? It was disgusting. But he got a deluge of harassing phone calls and a lot of death threats, and then some radio station picked it up and told the story and gave his phone number. So he was he couldn't even live at home.
Wow, this poor guy. He was totally targeted.
Yeah, you would think. So he sued AOL, and he wanted a couple of things. He wanted them to take it down. He wanted a retraction, and he wanted help figuring out who had done it to him. And guess what? Under 230, AOL didn't have to do any of those things. They didn't have to remove it. They eventually did, but only because they got bad press. But legally, they didn't have to remove it. They didn't have to issue retraction, which they never did. And they didn't have to help him figure out who put this up, which they never did.
Wow. So Section 230 gives a lot of, I don't know how to put it, options.
Freedom.
And options to online sites. This new trade deal that we're talking about today keeps that language
right in.
What's the impact of that? What do you think?
So, I mean, of course, it's the dream come true for the big tech companies because the real thing here is, you know, some of them will sometimes do some moderation, all voluntary, though. And really, it comes, in my view, at least, it comes down to money. Because if you're going to monitor things or moderate things, it costs money. You have to have people do this. You have
sure.
to develop software that do this. So they just don't have to do it. I mean, once in a while they may do something because it looks good or because they're getting bad press. But to Ken Zarin or you and I, they have absolutely no obligation. And trying to build it internationally, I think, is going to be, somewhat problematic because Canada has a very different view of hate speech than the United States. They don't have the same kind of First Amendment absolutism view that a lot of people in the United States have. If someone's getting hurt online, they actually have laws that say, let's help this person. Let's get it taken down. Maybe let's help them figure out, you know, who's causing this problem. So I'm very curious to see what'll happen with 230 because I think it's inconsistent with the domestic laws of Canada. I'm a little less clear about how it might affect Mexico because I think the situation there is more likely to be, as I understand it at least, it's more likely to be enforceable.
Explain this to me if you could, please, Anne. I thought First Amendment protections only extended to the public square, that in terms of private entities, they do have rights to limit speech, that you can't limit speech, you know, in a public place where people are protesting or in the halls of government. But in private spaces, you can limit speech.
No, you can limit speech. The issue is not if you can limit speech. The issue is if there's harmful speech, whether anybody has a remedy or not.
Uh-huh.
And that's not exclusive to the public domain. If someone with a private newspaper starts publishing naked pictures of you and threatens you and says that you did things you're not doing, you under tort law, you would have a cause of action.
But on right? the internet, you don't.
Well, not really. Not against the people who are in the best position to help you, right? I mean, they may not have put up the horrible speech, but they're in the best position to take it down, again, to issue a retraction, or third, to help you figure out who's putting this stuff up.
So if it creates harm, it doesn't apply to that, you know, that tried and true example of you can't yell fire in a crowded theater?
Well, it's a little different, actually. There are some exceptions to Section 230. One of them is for child pornography. One of them has to do with the Communications Privacy Act, and there's another more really controversial one on sex trafficking, which if you want I can talk about in a second. But the great irony of this is the other exception is for intellectual property law. So in other words, if let's just pick on Google for a second. If someone is posting your intellectual property up at Google, they have to take it down. They don't get immunity. But if someone is publishing threats about you, they don't have to do anything. So I think that this kind of shows an interesting list of priorities that Congress had when they passed this section, that copyright was more important than people's safety.
One more question for you, Anne. Again, given that you're with the Franklin Pierce Center for Intellectual Property, a lot of people have said, you know, it was high time that NAFTA was updated for a number of reasons, one of which, you know, the internet was barely born when this deal was penned. So here we are, you know, 25, almost 30 years later. What other sort of updates do you see that might be needed or that might have been needed from, you know, 25 years ago?
Well, so right now, I think the most controversial issue has to do with laws called SESTA and FOSTA. And the idea there is that when, for example, Backpage was one. When online service providers host basically advertisements that lead to the sex trafficking of people, generally children, that they should have some responsibility to deal with that, to monitor it, to try to make sure it wasn't children who were being trafficked or advertised, you know, the sexual services being advertised. And that has been the response to that has been, oh, my God, like it's the First Amendment's over. We have no more freedom anymore. I mean, the pushback is really severe. And people are very emotional about this issue. So I would like to see some obligation for responsive monitoring on the part of at least the big platforms. I would like to see them have to maybe help you figure out who's doing it so that you could sue them or negotiate with them to take it down.
No, it's really interesting what you said earlier, too, about how is this going to fly in Canada, which does
right.
have different
yes.
rules around speech and
yes,
so
it
forth.
Does.
Go
yes.
ahead, Anne. Did you want to add in one last point there?
Yeah, no. I would like to see that, but I'm not optimistic because I know from sort of the intellectual community around Section 230 that there are a lot of people that really believe in it, and they claim we'd have no internet without it, and all I have to say is, you know, companies like Google are all over the world, and most of the countries they're in don't have our First Amendment. And yet, they're making money there. They're there. You know, the internet doesn't die just because there's no Section 230 in other countries, so I don't think it would die here. But just saying that is like really, really, some people just really respond to that badly. They just want to see a continued sort of absolute First Amendment in cyberspace, and they want the United States to be exporting our First Amendment jurisprudence.
Well, Anne, really interesting to talk to you. It's complicated, and you really helped clear it up. Thank you.
You're welcome.
That's Ann Bartow, director of the Franklin Pierce Center for Intellectual Property and law professor at the UNH Franklin Pierce School of Law. Again, today in the Exchange, it's a New Hampshire look at the new U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement. There's a lot in here that affects us here in the Granite State, and we're finding out more this hour. And we welcome your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Once again, exchange at nhpr.org. And Jim Roach, to you real quickly, any thoughts also about what I asked, and just broadly, that when NAFTA was drawn up, was anybody even using email? I mean, it was a long time ago. I just wonder about this sort of idea of some of the stuff around intellectual property and, right, and digital commerce needed to be freshened.
Right. So, excuse me, in 1994, the Internet, the World Wide Web, was in its infancy. It really was not widespread use. E-commerce was new, so these kinds of issues were not a part of NAFTA. So one of the benefits of the USMCA is a new digital chapter that sets high standards for intellectual property products. So notwithstanding the concerns that Ann raised about Section 230, the USMCA does establish these new standards for IP, prohibits tariffs on digital products, requires anti-spam laws in the three countries, and creates copyright protections for proprietary software products, intellectual property protection. So these kinds of provisions were missing from NAFTA because the Internet wasn't around. So this is in the view of most business leaders and certainly some of the national groups that follow these issues very closely, like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the National Association of Manufacturers, is very important. And business generally are very pleased that these protections are now part of the USMCA.
Go ahead, Matthew.
To follow up on what Jim said and also what Ann was just talking about is should be evident to your listeners, these trade agreements are not just about tariffs and trade per se. They cover, they're in just about every aspect of our everyday lives. They're really, trade agreements have, are international treaties. They have the effect of law. They're really sort of an alternative lawmaking system. And if something is in a trade agreement that we sign, Congress and our state and local governing bodies are, you know, hard pressed to enact legislation or, you know, change what's in these trade agreements. Once the trade agreements are ratified by Congress, we all have to live under these agreements.
So if there are consequences and everybody says, oh, I didn't realize that was going to happen, it's kind of too late. You're bound by this agreement.
Right. And we talk about things like country of origin labeling on food. You know, we can no longer label meats that we see in our supermarket that they were made in the USA because that's considered an unfair barrier to trade. You know, dolphin-safe tuna. Remember, we used to see dolphin labels on the tuna. They had to be taken off because it was considered an unfair barrier to trade. So there's, you know, there's still a lot of stuff in this new NAFTA agreement that we're not particularly thrilled with. Definitely better than the old NAFTA, but there are still things that we think shouldn't be in trade agreements, and hopefully the next generation of trade agreements will be different.
Well, I think I read something about California beef producers were upset about,
right,
something in this new deal.
Family farmers.
They wanted to be able to say, hey, this is, you know,
sure,
this beef was produced right here in this country.
Yes, and you cannot put that label on, you know, on food.
You know, Matt's point, Jim, raises a bigger question, I think, and that is, are these agreements too big? I mean, looking at this yesterday, there's always someone who's not happy and who is concerned that if Americans say, you know, we want this, but oops, we're hamstrung by this agreement, would it be more, I don't know what the word is, effective, democratic, to do trade agreements smaller, like here's a trade agreement for manufacturing, here's a trade agreement for healthcare, rather than have these giant umbrella agreements that we have under this new NAFTA?
Well, two things. I think doing it that way would run the risk of creating sort of a patchwork quilt of trade relationships between industries and among countries, and it would be very complicated and probably counterproductive. You know, NAFTA up to now tripled trade among the three countries, the United States, Canada, and Mexico. It lowered the cost of consumer goods. It's credited with increasing the U.S. gross domestic product by 0.5% annually. And our economy grows at roughly 2 to 3% per year. So 0.5% contribution to that growth is pretty dramatic. And it increased direct foreign investment dramatically in each of the three countries. So Canadians investing in the United States investing in Mexico and Canada. So, you know, NAFTA was a very important trade agreement, which most economists think benefited all three countries. And just to be clear, notwithstanding Matt's criticisms of the USMCA, the AFL-CIO is supporting the USMCA. So the business community and the National Labor Organization, AFL-CIO, are on the same page here. And that's important to note because that doesn't happen very often.
Yeah, in fact, you know, I had to read it a couple times to make sure I got it right because it is a rare source of agreement. I'd love your thoughts too, Matt, on that. You represent not just the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, but you're on the Legislative Committee of the New Hampshire AFL-CIO.
Sure. The AFL-CIO is supporting this because if the choice is the old NAFTA or this new NAFTA is a substantial improvement. Not all unions are supporting it. The Machinist Union, for one, has decided not to support it.
And many, why is that?
Because they don't think it goes far enough in, you know, protecting workers. And it, in their opinion, it could be better. And I agree that it could be better. But I also understand that this is the deal we've got because of a lot of hard work that was done by organized labor and by congressional allies. We've got an enforcement regimen in Mexico that is going to, you know, potentially stop the ongoing damage. It won't bring back jobs, but it will stop, you know, potentially stop the loss of jobs.
One last quick question on the various criticisms and concerns, and both you and Jim are right. I mean, it is unusual to see Chamber of Commerce and the AFL-CIO coming together on this. Jen Kirby, when she was on with us earlier, Matt, mentioned that some environmental groups don't think that the environmental protections are strong enough in this deal. What's your opinion?
The Sierra Club has come out against this. A lot of environmental organizations have come out against it. Climate change is not even mentioned in this agreement. There are some modest improvements in climate protection, in environmental protection, I should say, in the agreement, but very modest. And the hope would be that future generations of trade agreements would do much more to protect our environment.
Coming up, we're going to bring in another New Hampshire voice. We will talk to someone who runs a national cross-border transportation and freight business based in Londonderry, but does a lot of business in Canada, Mexico, and China. So we'll talk to him after a short break, and we'll take your questions and comments about this new trade deal that we're hearing about. Not a done deal, but it looks like it will be soon. It's the new U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement, and we're looking specifically at its impact on us here in the Granite State. You can join us with an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org, or you can give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow morning at 9, live coverage from NPR of the U.S. House impeachment vote. That's Wednesday morning at 9. Today, a New Hampshire take on the new U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement. Let's hear your thoughts and questions. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Your comments about what this new deal might mean for New Hampshire. You can give us a call to 1-800-892-6477. You can comment on Facebook or tweet us. With me in studio is Jim Roach, president of the New Hampshire Business and Industry Association, and Matthew Beck, business representative for the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers in New Hampshire and Maine, and on the Legislative Committee of the New Hampshire AFL-CIO. Another voice I want to bring into our conversation, gentlemen, is Oscar Devlaminick. He's president of sales and marketing for Demanco Logistics, a national cross-border transportation and freight company based in Londonderry. And Oscar, it's really great to have you. Thank you for your time.
Yeah, thank you for having me on.
How important is trade with Canada and Mexico in your business? I almost feel silly asking you, Oscar, since you are a cross-border freight company.
Yeah, I think we have trucks moving north into Canada and coming southbound into the U.S. from Canada daily, as well as into Mexico and coming northbound. So it is essential. It helps a lot with the movement of the goods and in terms of the certainty now. I think this brings the New Deal, that where people were kind of looking to warehouse or stockpile things in advance, maybe not sure of what's going to happen, where we see a little bit of certainty knowing that this is going to pass in the manufacturing industries, you know, medical equipment, auto parts, some retail finished goods, things like that. That's what we're moving daily across the border, either south or northbound.
So an early Christmas present for people in your industry, Oscar.
Yeah, I would say so. I think it's a good thing to have that peace of mind.
What has the uncertainty over the North American Free Trade Agreement meant for you? Because as you're sort of alluding to, for a while there did seem to be a chance that NAFTA would be ripped up and nothing would replace it. So how did that affect your business and affect your company, your customers?
I think with such a massive market like the U.S. market that we have here in North America, it tends to ebb and flow naturally. But sometimes news like this, we see it impact us. Impact the amounts that are ordered or the timing that things are ordered, where we've been trucking along here, no pun intended, with this long agreement that we've had that seemed to have been working. And then when there's talks of it changing or going away, there are ripple effects that it does take a while to get down to the trucking industry, but we do see it happen where there have been some lulls. We had a little bit of a dry summer or a light summer, but we feel and we're hoping things for 2020 are trending in a different direction where they can pick up. And we're crossing the border almost every day, where in the past I think we saw a lot of full loads coming over, where now we saw in the last year or so more LTL or partial loads coming over, where I think the ordering may have been down a bit in terms of the raw materials and the catalyst needed to make these finished products would then ultimately come back into the U.S. for consumption.
Oh, that's interesting. So LTL is less than truckload, right, Oscar? So given the uncertainty, you're saying you were seeing more half-full trucks or less than truckload shipments because people weren't sure what was going to happen? Is that what you're saying there?
Yes, yeah.
Interesting. And you alluded to this, but I'd like to know a little bit more. What kinds of products are you helping bring over the border north and south?
We see a lot of automotive parts, everything from just components in terms of electrical components. We see engine parts. We do see a lot of medical equipment and retail goods, too, as well. Finished goods, a lot of goods come up from Mexico that ultimately go to a lot of the big retailers. We also have a lot of manufacturing equipment, whether they be components that go into the assembly line equipment. A lot of things do come in here to the U.S., and then we do deconsolidate them at the seaports, and then we're trucking up into Canada and southbound into Mexico. So there is a lot of flow of goods that do come here first. They get a touch, whether they're reworked, and then they go into Canada and Mexico to be either added to a finished product or they're altered in some way, repackaged, if you will, for the retail shelf or for the consumer market, and then they come back in. In most cases, again, it's medical equipment, automotive parts, retail goods, things that you would you would purchase like at the mall, a lot of clothing and items like that.
Wow, so that's a really interesting nuts and bolts description of international trade and how it happens, you know, right here in New Hampshire. Last question for you, Oscar, please. What's your message to those who don't like these free trade deals, who see them as responsible for sending jobs to other countries? As I'm sure you know, that was the big criticism of NAFTA, the predecessor to this new USMCA.
Yeah, I think it's a good thing anytime three big markets like this can come together and make an agreement for the greater good. I really do think that it's a positive step in the right direction. Again, one of your callers earlier had said that, you know, you can't really compare, you know, a U.S. worker to a Mexican worker wouldn't be fair in that regard. And I think hopefully some of these changes may help balance out make that a more level playing field, a little bit more fair for everyone involved. But ultimately, I think with such a massive market that we have here in the U.S., we're helping the emerging market in Mexico grow. We're helping maintain in Canada by buying and welcoming these agreements. So I feel that it is a great thing. It's a good thing for our economy. It's a good thing for everyone involved. You know, the trucks keep rolling, and we keep we keep in business, and we keep continuing to grow and keep the economy healthy.
Well, Oscar, it's good to talk to you. It's been really interesting to learn just what's in those trucks and what's going on when I see them out on the road. So I really appreciate you being with us.
Yeah, thank you.
That's Oscar Devlemenik. He's president of sales and marketing for Domenco Logistics, as we heard, a national cross-border transportation and freight business based in Londonderry. One more time, our number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And both of you, a couple emails have come in. Arnie says, does NAFTA 2.0 offer any additional protections to U.S. workers who seek to organize unions, including in the public sector? And Matt, I'll throw that one to you first.
Not really. I know one of the original Canadian proposals was to include an elimination of so-called right-to-work laws in the United States, and that was obviously a non-starter for the Trump administration. What it does is really potentially improve things for Mexican workers, which, you know,
potentially
could help American workers in the long run.
So how do we know that everybody's abiding by the rules? I'll ask you first, Matt, but I want to hear from you too, Jim. You know, no trade agreement is worth much if there isn't enforcement and oversight.
So the enforcement regimen in Mexico does look to be substantially improved. There'll be inspectors that will be able to go into Mexican manufacturing facilities and within 160 days assess modest fines for a first violation, heavier fines for a second violation. And for a third violation, they could block all goods being made by a Mexican company that's violating labor standards. And there will actually be facility-specific enforcement where they can really, you know, drill down and figure out what's going on in these facilities.
Wow, that's a big job. Mexico's a big country. There's a lot of production there. Who's
They'll go after some, you know, big fish first, uh-huh. Just try to set an example for everybody else. And another thing that they'll be able to do is over a period of 4 years, they'll be able to eliminate these, you know, fake unions that are down there and give people, Mexican workers, the real right to organize into unions of their own.
To Arnie's question. And Arnie, thank you for writing in. Jim, what enforcement provisions do you see and how robust are they?
Well, Matt talked about the enforcement provisions for labor, you know, the wage issue and workplace safety and kind of the regulatory structure within workplaces in Mexico, Canada, beyond what the United States is doing. But all three countries have very sophisticated review and adjudication processes if one country feels the other country isn't playing fair in a certain aspect of the USMCA and NAFTA up to now. So, I mean, these systems are baked into all three federal governments. And I'm not an expert, but this, you know, that's the way international trade works.
Yeah. Go ahead, Matt. And then
another
question.
Yeah, a big improvement to the new NAFTA is the elimination of the ISDS, the investor state dispute settlement mechanism, which was a tribunal that would be set up with three corporate lawyers, not a transparent court like we're used to in the United States, to settle the disputes. And the Fair Trade a coalition has been trying to eliminate ISDS for a long time, and this essentially does it.
Another aspect of this that we haven't talked about yet that I did want to touch on briefly is pharmaceutical companies. And Jim Roach, I'll turn to you first. I have read that while so-called big tech was pretty happy with this deal because of some of the provisions that Ann Bartow told us about earlier, big pharma, as people call it, was less happy. So what happened in terms of pharmaceutical companies under this deal?
So there was a provision that was removed from the USMCA that would have forced other countries to follow the U.S. patent protections for biologic drugs. These are drugs that are made in living cells. And by removing that protection, it is felt by some that that may impact the cost of drugs. In other words, help drive the cost of drugs down. So, you know, big pharma is under a lot of scrutiny nowadays. And so they were not able to muster support to keep that provision in.
So they had hoped for, it was a pretty long patent protection period, and that was ultimately taken out of the deal. Yeah. Yeah, go ahead, Matt.
And most importantly, had that been in the final agreement, it would have made it impossible for Congress to pass future legislation to lower drug prices because we would have been handcuffed by the USMCA.
Well, and Canada and Mexico probably had a lot to say on that because drug prices are a lot lower in those countries, so they probably wouldn't want to be tied to the American system that offers this protection, which can raise prices.
Absolutely.
What's the most important aspect, Jim, of this trade deal, in your opinion, that you really think our listeners need to know about?
Well, businesses are reluctant to invest if there is uncertainty in the economy, if there's uncertainty regarding laws and regulations and tariffs for exporting into other countries and importing products and services. So the USMCA does two things. It preserves trade among our three countries, and as we've talked about, this is the largest trading, you know, block and relationship in the world between these three nations. And there are a lot of jobs and economic activity here in New Hampshire and across the country that are directly tied to these relationships. So it preserves what has been a very successful three-country trade relationship up to now, and it creates opportunities to strengthen that and create even further benefits for those of us here in New Hampshire and across the country and in the other two countries as well, Canada and Mexico.
So look at the big picture. There may be little pieces that you don't like, but look at the big picture.
Right. You know, as you said, businesses, they're not going to invest. They're not going to make those investments if there is uncertainty out there. So by passing the USMCA, the uncertainty of whether or not NAFTA would continue is eliminated. And businesses need that to invest in their products and their services and their employees.
Well, that's a message we heard also from Oscar at Domenico Logistics. So what do you think, Matt, if you could just leave people with one aspect of this trade deal that you really want them to understand or appreciate, what would that be?
I think what's important to remember is that although this is an improvement, this should be the floor for future trade agreements. Working people in New Hampshire and throughout the United States and abroad deserve trade policies that prioritize the creation of a more just and sustainable global economy. So I think we need to continue pushing for a new model of trade that delivers fully on that fundamental goal.
Yeah, you've talked about we hope that future deals will improve even on this deal. Are you suggesting that unions will push for a renegotiation of this deal in a couple years? Or
I suggest that we have a moratorium on new trade agreements until we figure out a way to have an agreement that protects the economy, protects people's jobs, and really, you know, protects the environment for, you know, the years to come.
Do you want to jump in on that, Jim?
Well, just that NAFTA was open-ended, and the USMCA has a 16-year shelf life, so it sunsets after 16 years. And it's either 6 years or 10 years the three countries will get together and start making fixes addressing shortcomings to the USMCA, assuming it passes Congress.
Yeah, which it looks like it will, from what we heard earlier from Jen Kirby. Yeah.
Jen may not have been willing to make a prediction, but I'll make a prediction. It's going to pass.
So very quickly, I did want to ask both of you this. A lot of people looking at this deal, and like you said, Matt, saying, you know, it looks like it's going to pass. There seems to be a sentiment that if this passes and, you know, things look good for a while with this deal, or at least stable, that it might create an opportunity to open up and improve trade relations with China? And I wonder what either of you think. Does this sort of create a happier space where people might be willing to come to the table with China? What do you think, Jim?
Well, you know, it seems like compromise is a dirty word in Washington, D.C. these days, which is really unfortunate. So to the extent that this trade agreement shows support from organized labor and the business community, Republicans and Democrats and the president, that's a very healthy outcome. And one can only hope that that resonates through the rest of the policy debate, be it trade or, you know, domestic spending or whatever the case may be. We are so siloed nowadays, unfortunately, politically, that in the old days, compromise was where you got a little bit, you didn't get everything, that was okay. And frankly, that's what the USMCA is. It's a compromise. And hopefully that will translate to, into other aspects of our national trade policy and other domestic policy issues.
Well, we will haul both of you back in when there is a trade deal with China. I really want to thank both of you right now for being with us today. Matt, it was good to see you. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Laura.
Matthew Beck, business representative for the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers in New Hampshire and Maine, and he serves on the legislative committee of the New Hampshire AFL-CIO. And Jim Roach, good to see you too. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Laura.
Jim Roach, president of the Business and Industry Association of New Hampshire, representing 400 members in industries including manufacturing, financial services, high tech, healthcare, and more. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. The producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoi.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Stitcher for NHPR Exchange.